So my talk today will mostly be, or in fact entirely be, completely standard on Feynman diagrams. So if you know all about Feynman diagrams and how to derive them, you know, you can fall asleep, or alternatively, well, leave the room, or alternatively, so here are a few pictures that I took, I think two in Bogota and five in Portugal, and they're all logos of banks, except I'm lying because I think this one is the stock exchange, but it's the same. And this one might be a charity, I'm not 100% sure. Anyway, the riddle for you is which knot appears here twice? So there are seven pictures, and only one knot appears twice. Okay? So of course these are knots and links, and the Banco for Brazil, Banco de Brazil, is really a long knot. Okay, so I mean, strictly speaking, it's not knotted, but if you connect the two ends out through infinity, then it becomes a knot. Anyway, so which knot appears twice, or link appears twice in this picture? Anyway, my talk today will follow a handout, so it's the second page of yesterday's handout and a new handout that I just wrote yesterday afternoon, and it's handwritten, and I'm sorry, my handwriting is horrible. And let me remind you where we were. So we defined the Stonehenge pairing of a diagram of a knot by counting cosmic coincidences that are based on that knot, but that have the combinatorial structure of that diagram. We formed the generating function of all such cosmic coincidences, and it was a formal combination, a formal linear combination of diagrams of pictures, so just a formal linear combination of pictures. And then the claim is that modulus certain relations, this strange sum is a knot invariant, and in fact these relations are drawn here. I didn't prove the theorem, but at least I motivated it. Oops, the motivation sort of flashed through the screen too quickly. I gave you an example to explain how one of these relations arises. And then I said that this combinatorial cosmic astrological picture is really a restatement, in some sense, of Chern-Simons Witten theory, and that's where I want to start today. So Chern-Simons Witten theory is a path integral. It's an infinite dimensional integral over the space of all connections, so Lie algebra valued 1 forms. For each connection, you take the exponential of the so-called Chern-Simons form of that connection, which is in itself an integral over R3 of something quadratic in the connection, so A wedge dA, plus something cubic in the connection. And all of this is multiplied by the holonomy along the knot of the connection K. And then I claim that when you expand this path integral in terms of Feynman diagrams, and play around a tiny bit, but not too much, the end result is the invariant that I wrote before. And of course, the statement does not even make sense until we understand what expanding in Feynman diagrams means. So my first goal is to understand what Feynman diagrams are and how they arise. So Feynman diagrams are a technique for computing the Taylor expansion of infinite dimensional integrals that depend on a small parameter. So if the integrand depends on a small parameter, you expect the integral you expect to be able to expand the power, the integral as a power series in this small parameter. And what Feynman diagrams do is they tell you how to compute the first few coefficients, or you know, if you're patient enough and you're ready to make large computations and even many more coefficients of that Taylor expansion. So they roughly compute infinite dimensional integrals. Now, how do they work? Well, really what happens is we look at a finite dimensional analog, and then it turns out that in the finite dimensional analog, you can write the answer in a way that does not depend on the dimension. Or more precisely, depends on the dimension very, very mildly. And then what you do is you just substitute infinity for the dimension and you get the result for path integrals, for infinite dimensional integrals. So let's start with the finite dimensional analog. So let us study, so here's the situation. We have V, which is a vector space, okay? Think finite dimensional, think Rn. But later it could be the vector space of all Lie algebra valued 1 forms. So later it will be infinite dimensional, but as a start, think finite dimensional vector space. dV will denote the Lebesgue measure on that vector space. Q will be a quadratic form on V, and I expect Q to be non-degenerate. Okay? I'll explain what that means in a second, but the analog of Q, or Q is the analog of A wedge dA, which is quadratic in A, or more precisely, it's the analog of the integral over R3 of the trace of A wedge dA. So Q is a quadratic form. Now let's assume that V had a standard inner product on it. So the quadratic form can be written as, I didn't even assume that, sorry. So let me say it differently. So the quadratic form can always be written as L, so Q on a vector V is equal to L of V, comma V, where V is a map from, where L is a map from the vector space to its dual. So LV will be the dual, and you can evaluate it on V itself. And the statement that I want Q to be non-degenerate is the same as saying that I want L to be invertible. And that's crucial, absolutely crucial. If L is not invertible, I don't know what to do. If L is not invertible, we need a completely new bag of tricks. Okay, and now the integral I want to compute, and again, that's the analog of the Chern-Simons integral, is the integral over the vector space relative to Lebesgue's measure of the exponential of 1/2 times the quadratic form plus p, where p you should be thinking of as a perturbation. So on one hand, it should be like a cubic thing, but on the other hand, it should be preceded, it should be in some sense small. So you should be thinking of it as if P contains some epsilon in it, where epsilon is a small number. Okay? So since P is small, I can expand this as a power series in P. And you see, I just have e to the P. E to the P is sum of 1 over m factorial times p to the m. So I can rewrite this integral before as the sum as m goes from 0 to infinity of 1 over m factorial times the integral over the vector space of p to the m times e to the q over 2. And this is really the integral that I will want to compute. Now, the equality here has quotations around it because really, I'm not thinking about convergence, okay? Everything that I do is at the level somehow of generating functions, and I don't care about convergence. And in fact, convergence is a major issue. Convergence is not guaranteed at all, okay? And generally false. Generally, it's some sort of asymptotic expansion as opposed to really a Taylor expansion. But again, let me not worry about this. The point of this exercise is more to provide an inspiration than to be rigorous mathematically. Okay. Next, I use Fourier analysis. Okay? And a tiny bit of Fourier analysis. So let me move on and remind you what is the Fourier analysis that I need. So I need to know about the Fourier transform, which does the following. Given a function from a vector space to the complex numbers, of course with conditions, continuous, L2, L1, I don't know, but I'm not worried about such things today. Okay? So given a function from the vector space to the complex numbers, it produces a function, f tilde, from the dual of the vector space to the complex numbers, defined as follows. So f tilde defined on a linear function on phi is the integral over the original vector space of f of v times e to the minus I times the evaluation of the linear function of phi on the vector v, dv. I'm sure you all know, you've all seen that. Okay? I need just a tiny bit of little facts about the Fourier transform. So one little fact that I need is that the Fourier transform at zero is simply the integral. Because if you take phi equals zero here, then it's e to the zero is one, so it's just the integral of the function. Next, if you differentiate the Fourier transform with respect to phi, it's the Fourier transform of the function multiplied by v. Okay? Right? If you have a function on a vector space, you can always multiply it by the ith coordinate, vi. Okay? So, if you differentiate, and then take the Fourier transform. So the Fourier transform of multiplying by a coordinate is differentiating, well, you differentiate the transform. Okay? And there is a tilde here, and I think tilde in my notation means equality up to factors of pi, I, 2, things like that. Okay? So, essential equality. Signs as well, sorry, you're right, I forgot about signs. Okay. And finally, and most crucially, the Fourier transform of e to the quadratic, over 2, I suppose, is e to the quadratic you get on the dual by inverting the original quadratic, and you also throw in a minus sign. Okay? So you see, if you have a quadratic function and it's not degenerate, then, well, remember that what's a quadratic function? What's a quadratic functional? A quadratic functional is determined by an operator L going from V to V dual. Its dual will be an operator, sorry, its inverse will be an operator going from V dual to V. And V is the dual of V dual. So, L inverse will define a quadratic form on V dual. This is the quadratic form that I call Q inverse. Now, the first two facts I'm sure everybody knows very well. The last fact, if you don't know it, well, of course I can prove it in about 5 minutes, but maybe it's better if I leave it as an exercise, okay? It's an absolutely wonderful exercise. It's the key point in Fourier analysis for why the Fourier inversion formula holds. So you know, one? Yeah, it's a Gaussian integral. Yeah. Yes, it's a significant point that one has to know. But again, why is it about related to the Fourier inversion formula? So you know, the Fourier inversion formula says that if you apply the Fourier transform twice, you get more or less the function you started from. Again, up to some sign somewhere. Okay? So if you look at this, this verifies the Fourier inversion formula for Gaussians. Because if you take the Fourier transform twice, then you take the Fourier transform of that, then you need to invert Q inverse, but the inverse of Q inverse is Q, and you also need to, well, I mean, you get back where it started. So this is the Fourier inversion formula for Gaussians. But you see, since we know how the Fourier transform behaves under shifts, I guess I didn't write it because I don't need it, but it's again an elementary fact. We know how the Fourier transform behaves under shifts, under translations. It follows that the Fourier transform, the inversion formula holds not only for Gaussians, but also for shifted Gaussian. But any function in the world, right, take any function, well, any function is a linear combination of shifted Gaussians. Well, you just take a Gaussian, sort of sum of Gaussians that lie underneath it, and that kind of, well, the claim is that you can approximate every function in the world by shifted, by a sum of shifted Gaussians. And since the Fourier inversion formula holds for the Gaussians, it holds for the function. So very roughly speaking, this is the key point or the key in the proof of the key fact about the Fourier transform. Anyway, back to our story. So, where was I? I needed to compute the integral of a polynomial, well, raised to the power m, but that's still a polynomial, times a Gaussian. M?
L, I mean the Q.
Q. I'm assuming Q is negative for convergence, or maybe imaginary. But all of this is somehow...
This is formal.
Formal, yes. So, I mean, I'm not... I mean, for this to actually converge, Q has to be either negative definite or imaginary, and then you have to explain what you mean by convergence. But I'm not worrying about such things. Okay? So anyway, I have the integral of a polynomial times a Gaussian. But you see, integration, after you take Fourier transform, becomes evaluation at zero. Multiplying by a variable becomes differentiating. So multiplying by a polynomial becomes applying a differential operator, the differential operator that you get by substituting derivatives into this polynomial. So if the polynomial was v to the 7, you would be differentiating with respect to phi 7 times. Okay? And the Gaussian becomes, well, the Gaussian with the inverse quadratic form and an extra minus sign for good measure. Okay? So, altogether, this integral up to factors of pi 2, I, and 1, sorry, all of these are equal to 1, up to that, this is, you know, really what I'm writing here is I don't want to bore you with the factors. It's not that the factors are hard or anything. They just make the formulas uglier. But they're not hard or complicated or anything like that. In the finite dimensional case, none of them is infinite. In the infinite dimensional case, some of them are better ignored. Okay, so anyway, what I get is, again, take p to the m, convert it to a differential operator, but by substituting derivatives into the variables. Take the quadratic form, invert it, and exponentiate, and then evaluate everything at phi equals zero. Okay? And then the final thing that I do before even before that, notice the great news. There was an integral here. There was an integral sign here. There is no integral sign here. We have evaluated the integral. Okay? This is just an algebraic formula. So now it's only a matter of understanding this algebraic formula, making it more manageable. Okay? The big deal was already done. The integral was computed. Anyway, so the next thing I do is I expand this as a power series as well. Okay? So this becomes a double summation as m and n go from 0 to infinity, and this power series contributes the 2 to the n, n factorial minus 1 to the n, and I get u inverse to the n, and the rest just stays. Okay? And then this is what I have to understand. So what I really have to understand is how a high-order differential operator acts on a quadratic to the nth power, so on a polynomial of degree 2n, if you wish, evaluated at zero. So I mean, after the polynomial, after the derivative, the differential operator acts on the polynomial, you evaluate at zero. I mean, these are just factors, and this is the key part that I have to understand. So let's go back to grade 3 or so, elementary school, and remember how differentiation acts. So what's the derivative? So let's do differentiation in a very, really simple case. So let's take the third derivative with respect to x times the second derivative with respect to y of the polynomial x cubed y squared. By the way, had I taken x to a lower power, I would get 0 because I have too many derivatives. Had I taken x with a higher power, I wouldn't care about it because at the end I substitute x equals to 0, or rather, phi equals to 0 in the previous slide. So if I had leftover x's after I had done all the differentiations, that would get killed. So the only polynomial I could care about if I apply this differential operator is the polynomial x cubed y squared. Now, I'm sure you know that this is 3 factorial times 2 factorial, but let me prove it to you. So the proof is there are 3 x differential operators. Think of them as piranha fish, whatever you know, have sharp teeth, they want to bite x's. Okay. There are also 2 y's that want, derivative with respect to y, that want to bite y's. I have 3 x's and 2 y's, and each x eater, biter, wants to pair with one of the x's and bite it, and then the two disappear from the scene. Okay? But each x derivative can act on any of the x factors in x cubed. So overall, you get a sum of pairings in which you pair the x factors with the x differentiation with the x's and the y differentiation with the y's. So you get a sum of 3 factorial permutations from here and 2 factorial permutations from here, and hence the answer is this, and of course this generalizes. That was just an illustration. So now I want to do the same in the case that I cared about. So suppose P was a cubic, right? Remember, P was always some polynomial of high degree, and I took it to the power n. So suppose P in itself was a cubic. So it came with coefficients lambda I, j, k, which multiply the derivative with respect to I, the derivative with respect to j, the derivative with respect to k. Sorry, P had variables in it, but I've substituted operator, differential operators in P. So this is P raised to the power 2. And this is a differential operator with respect to C, of degree 6. So the pairing has to give me something non-zero, I have to pair it with a polynomial of degree 6. The polynomial that appears in the pairing is always a power of the inverse quadratic form. Quadratic is degree 2, so I better take the third power of the inverse quadratic form. So it's the third power of, well, now I switch to coefficients, so let's declare that lambda pq is the matrix whose of coefficients of the quadratic form. So it's lambda pq phi t phi q, and that's the derivative I want to compute. So I have to line up 6 differential operators. So really this is differentiation with respect to I, with respect to j, with respect to k, I mean with respect to phi I, phi j, phi k, and then, but you see, this summation here is a dummy summation, okay? There is an implicit summation symbol here. So the second time I use this differential operator, I think I want to use a second set of variables. So I'll call it lambda I prime, lambda j prime, lambda k prime times differentiation with respect to I prime, or in the direction of I prime, in the direction of j prime, in the direction of k prime. And this has to act on phi t times phi q with coefficient lambda pq, phi p prime, phi q prime with coefficient lambda p prime, q prime, and then you know what the last one is. So what is the answer? The answer is, it's a sum over all ways of pairing the phi biters with the phis. So it's a sum of all, the answer is a sum over all such red permutations. Now, when a lambda I, when a derivative with respect to I is acting on a monomial, you get zero unless the monomial is the ith monomial, sorry, the ith variable. Sorry, so when the derivative acts on a variable, you get zero if the indices are different and one if they're equal. So really, in here, you get non-zero contribution only if, like, the I here is equal to the Q here, and the J here is equal to the P here, and the K here is equal to the Q prime here, and so on. Yes?
Excuse
me, are those missing, or are they intrinsic? So, for example, a phi p, a phi q prime,
do
they have?
No, I have a
phi p prime, phi q prime.
No, phi p, p's and primes. Non-primes and primes. Yes.
No. Because I'm taking, what I'm doing is I'm taking lambda pq phi p phi q and raise it to the third power.
Yeah, but in the product you have phi p.
Oh, this is a product. This represents a product, right? The things at the bottom here represents a product of phi p phi q, phi p prime phi q prime. This is a product of 6 phi's with a coefficient which is lambda pq, lambda p prime, q prime, lambda p double prime, q double prime. Okay? You don't...
Yeah.
You can put the function coefficients in there.
I guess all I'm saying...
The function coefficients to the diagram.
Yes.
You didn't tell them.
Sorry, what coefficients?
That
cross arrows
between the two first blocks.
No, there are no cross arrows. There's no need.
With the delta.
No. Look. All I'm saying. Let's do it sort of in. So lambda p q. Phi p phi q raised to the second power, let me do because I'm lazy, This is equal to, well, again, this is a summation, right? So this is equal to, well, you know what, first of all, let's write it as, sorry, I didn't want to write the sum, the summation is understood. So this is lambda pq phi p phi q times the same quantity, lambda pq phi p phi q. But you see, this is the summation variables here are dummy variables. I can rename them. So this is lambda phi prime q prime p, you know, I just add primes everywhere. And now this is a summation with respect to two variables. This is a summation with respect to two other variables. The end result, I can pull the summation out. So it's a summation over pq, p prime, and q prime of lambda pq, lambda p prime, q prime, phi p, phi q, phi p prime, phi q prime. Okay, and this is exactly what I wrote here. Right, this represents, just like over here, x, x, y, x, y, y represented x cubed, y squared, this represents the product of the phi's with coefficients, which are these products of lambdas. So my notation is, I think, consistent. Is it, did I?
IJK. Yeah. Why don't we have things going to the last one?
Oh, it could. It could. There is a summation here. Sorry. There is a summation over all red permutations. And I, just like here, there was a summation, and that's why I wrote 3 factorial, 2 factorial. Here, there is a big summation over all red permutations. And I just wrote one, you know, the one that came up. Okay. I don't know, in my mind. Okay, sorry. Okay, anyway. How am I doing? 32 minutes. Okay. So, I claim that this term, well, first of all, if you look at this term, you can think of it as a graph. Sort of the red pieces serve to join blue pieces with purple pieces. So if you kind of contract them, you just get a graph with red, with blue vertices and purple edges. So one of these two graphs. In fact, I think you get, in this case, I wrote the same graph twice. Sorry, I'm an idiot. But in this case, I think the graph you get is the Harry Potter okay? I'm trying to organize a trip to Tuna on Sunday. I hope we all go to see the last Harry Potter movie. Sorry. Okay. So, and furthermore, I claim that once you know the graph, you know the corresponding term, the corresponding sum. Why? Because you see, you just have to label the three edges, emanating from a vertex with ijk. Okay? Now, I don't know if it's going to be ijk or I prime, j prime, k prime, but it doesn't matter because these are dummy variables anyway. So I'm going to label this with I, J, K, and the other vertex with I prime, J prime, K prime. In principle, I also have to label the sort of purple things with P's and Q's, but we've already agreed that the P here is equal to the index above that is connected to it, so to j. Okay? So, you know, I should have also put here p's and q's, but I don't need to because p is equal to I. Okay? So, what I've labeled is enough. And then out of this labeling, I can get a term, a factor. And the factor would be, well, a product of lambdas for the vertices, so lambda I, J, K, lambda, I prime, J prime, K prime, times a product of inverse lambdas, or inverse quadratic lambdas for the edges. So lambda ij for this edge, so lambda upper ij for this edge, lambda kj prime for the middle edge, lambda kj prime for the middle edge, times lambda j prime k prime for the right edge. So once you know the graph, you know the corresponding term. Hence, I don't remember what's on the next transparency. I hope I have it right.
Just to remind
you. I didn't even summarize. Yes.
Just for the fact that there are three names to a vertex is related to the fact that you took a power cube.
Correct. It's related to the fact that I took a cubic perturbation. Had it been a perturbation of degree 5, the graph would be a graph with vertices of order 5. Okay? The edges come from the quadratic form, and they are always the inverse of the quadratic form. The vertices come from the perturbation, and they have valency depending on the perturbation. If the perturbation was a linear combination of something in degree 4 and something in degree 5, I would have degree 4 vertices and degree 5 vertices as well. Okay? So basically the answer would be a sum over the two Feynman diagrams that you can write with two vertices and three edges. And I guess they're not the two that are written here. It's this one and the eyeglasses one. And for each such graph, it's a matter of combinatorics to count how many times it will arise, from how many different permutations it will arise. But it's relatively mild combinatorics. It's some product of factorials divided by the order of the automorphism group of the graph. And then for each such graph, you write the corresponding product of lambdas, and that's the end of the computation. Okay? So I did it in the sample case where m was equal to 2. Of course, if m was equal to 17, you'll have 17 vertices and you'll get more complicated graphs. So this is it. This is Feynman diagrams.
This is a recombination of
Wick. But you know, if it fits in essentially two or three transparencies, then maybe it's not a reformulation of anything. It's its own. You know, it's maybe. Other things might be reformulation of this. Sorry. Okay. Anyway, what happens in our case? So, in our case, the quadratic form, okay, was A wedge dA. So, essentially, the differential operator D. So, the inverse of a differential operator is typically an integral operator. So Q inverse will be an integral operator. The term P is 2/3 A wedge A wedge A, so it's cubic. And we have another thing, okay? We have another source for a polynomial that multiplies the Gaussian, okay? And this is the holonomy. Now, what's a holonomy? So I defined it last time, or I mentioned what it is last time, but I want to tell you what its Taylor expansion is now, because I want to think of it as a, because I want it to be a polynomial. I mean, I want it to be, I want to think of it as a sum of polynomials, so I need to Taylor expand it. I didn't plan to say it in this order, but I think I wrote it in the following page. So the holonomy is really the following thing. So first of all, let me remind you what it is. The holonomy along the curve gamma of the one form A, one form with values in the Lie algebra, is sort of the formal product, or the so-called prodigal, the product integral, of, so you take the product along the node, along the curve gamma, of, well, for each point of gamma, you get an element of the Lie algebra, because you can feed the tangent vector to gamma to the one form A, and you get an element of the Lie algebra. So you get an element of the Lie algebra for each point along the curve, and you multiply them, and it's a non-commutative product, so you multiply them in their order along the curve, the circle. And then you take the trace. Now, strictly speaking, you don't multiply the elements of the Lie algebra, but rather you think of an element of the Lie algebra as an infinitesimal element of the group. Okay? So it's really, as an infinitesimal element of the group, you should be thinking of it as 1 plus the element of the Lie algebra. It's near the identity. So the issue is to figure out what's a very, very long product of 1 plus elements of the Lie algebra. So suppose you have a very, very large number of elements of the Lie algebra. Let's call them, I don't know what, x1 up to, again, it's a very, very long list, up to x capital N. Again, and I'm taking the limit as n goes to infinity in some sense, because I want to multiply along all points of the node. Okay? And what I want to do is to evaluate 1 plus x1, that's an element of the group, times 1 plus x2, that's again an element of the group, times 1 plus x3, times, and so on, many, 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 many terms, up to 1 plus xn. But let me also remind you that these elements are sort of to be thought of as infinitesimal, as very, very small. So, you know, either you put here an epsilon to remind yourself that these are very small, or you just remember that a term with two x's is way smaller than a term with one x. So now let's open the parentheses here. If you open the parentheses, you get, well, the biggest term is the term where you take just the ones, because the ones are big, the x's are small. So you get 1. The next biggest term is when you take 1x from one of the factors, and all the other factors you take 1. So the next biggest term will be just x1 times a bunch of 1s, and then 1 times x2 times a bunch of 1. So it's essentially the sum of the xi's as I go from 1 to capital N. The next term, you take 2 x's and the rest are 1s. But the two x's could come from anywhere. So you could be taking, for any I less than j, you could be taking xi times xj, right? Plus a summation over I less than j less than k of xi, xj, xk, plus and so on. And this is the Taylor expansion of that. Now let's convert it to the continuous limit. Okay, so think of, so strictly speaking, to convert it to the continuous limit, I have to take the limit as n goes to infinity, but also make this smaller and smaller. But again, I don't want to bother with that. The end result is clear. The end result is that this will go to 1 plus, this will become the integral of x at the point s. The next thing will become the integral over s1 less than s2 of x at the point s1 times x at the point s2. And then so on. So back to the language of connections, this is, so h bar is what I call epsilon over there, and so the term without h bar is 1. The term with 1 h bar is the integral of a evaluated on the tangent to the curve gamma at the point s. Right, this is what x at the point s is. This is the Lie algebra element at the point s. The next term is a squared times the integral over s1 less than s2 of the same thing here. I mean, the product here. This is, by the way, a non-commutative product. This is an element of a these are matrices, if you wish. Anyway, so back to perturbation theory. So the holonomy is really a sum of vertices. It's not a single vertex. It's a sum of vertices of higher and higher degree. Okay? It's a vertex of degree 0, which is not interesting, then a vertex of degree 1, then a vertex of degree 2, then a vertex of degree 3, and so on. So the vertex of degree 8, instead of marking it as a vertex with 8 legs coming out, I will mark it kind of dually. I will mark it as a circle. It also somehow suggests where it came from. So I will mark it as a circle with 8 lines coming in. Okay? Yes?
I have a question about the application of your former Gaussian integral computation. So D is not positive. So what do you do about that?
I'm in trouble, and I'll have to fix this trouble later. So far, I'm sort of pretending the trouble is not there. In the next, you know, if you look at the next page of the handout, you'll see that I work hard.
Okay.
Okay, so still, at the level of schematics, what's the Gaussian integral, or what's the Feynman diagram evaluation of the Chern-Simons integral? Well, now that we have all the pieces in place, degree operator for each holonomy, Q inverses and all, but let me write it maybe in a better way on the blackboard. So let's go back to the slide showing the Chern-Simons theory, and here it is. So the evaluation of this integral is equal to, so this equality sign continues the formula on the a big sum over Feynman diagrams. And for each Feynman diagram, so let me draw a typical, let me tell you what the structure of a typical Feynman diagram will be. So a typical Feynman diagram will have one vertex called the holonomy, and instead of drawing it like this, I will draw it sort of facing in, so it's a vertex like this. I made it too big, okay, but anyway. Now, what does this vertex stand for? It stands for an iterated integral along the knot of 4, 5, 6, 7 variables. Okay? So it's an integral like here of S1 less than S2 less than S3 and so on along the node, which ran along the node. This is the term coming from the holonomy. Then I get vertices coming from A wedge, A wedge, A, and each such vertex is cubic. So basically I make a graph, a cubic graph out of these things. This is not a vertex. The graph is not required to be planar. The graph, the vertices are only the cubic things. Sorry, so this is not a vertex. Okay, so I make a graph like this. For each cubic term, I have two things. Well, the cubic term here is an A wedge A wedge A. A wedge A wedge A is sort of a polynomial, or it's a polynomial in the coefficients of A. Okay? So it's going to be with various, which in itself has some coefficients. Okay? And these coefficients have to do with the wedge product in R3, so it has to do with epsilon ijk symbols. And it also has to do with some Lie algebra stuff. In fact, the structure constants of the Lie algebra. So basically, for each vertex here, you will have some factors that come from the Lie algebra, so TABC, and from the structure of R3, so epsilon IJK, and things like that. But furthermore, I mean, the cubic term is not just this at some specific point. It's this. It's integrated over R3. So it's the sum of such terms, one for each point of R3. So there will be also a variable in R3 for each one of the vertices, and you have to integrate over all of these. Okay? So, and finally, for each edge, like here, you will have an integral operator corresponding to the inverse of the quadratic form. So to the inverse of D. Okay? So overall, you will get a sum of Feynman diagrams. And for each Feynman diagram, you will be generating a huge expression which I will call epsilon of D, which I will call E of D. This huge expression I more or less told you how to construct here. And this expression will involve many combinatorial indices and many continuous indices, the X's and the S's. So you will take the sum integral over all those indices, so sum over all discrete indices and integral over all continuous indices. And the truth is, what I did here is that I factored out the Lie algebra indices. So there are different types of indices. There are R3 indices that run from 1 to 3, and Lie algebra indices that run from 1 to the dimension of the Lie algebra. And I factored out all the Lie algebra indices to the outside. Okay? And then my claim is that if you sort of formally replace this piece with just D itself, so now it becomes a sum over, this was a number. This is a formal linear combination of diagrams, and my claim is that this is the formal linear combination of diagrams that we talked about before. Okay, I am at minute 54 of my talk. I don't have time to justify everything.
What's epsilon D?
What?
Epsilon D.
E of D is this huge expression that you construct out of the diagram by labeling all the vertices with the correct indices and the correct points in R3, and by replacing all the edges by the corresponding integral operators.
And how do you
know the D factors? The D factors, which D factor?
Well,
oh,
D.
This?
No, no, the next. Yeah,
this? So this is.
this is, if you wish, it's actually, it's not coming from the physics. This is sort of an extra thing that I allow myself to do. So you see, since this will work for any Lie algebra, I mean, if something is true for any Lie algebra, so I get for any Lie algebra, given a diagram, I can form the corresponding sum of Lie algebra indices and get a number. So since this works for any Lie algebra, I can replace it by the formal D. Instead of working with all Lie algebras, I just replace it by D itself.
So you change the E then?
Already here I factored out the Lie algebra part from E.
Physics is called the color factorization of all of the composition.
Maybe. It's some sort of universalization.
I
could say a lot more about it, but probably not in the 4 minutes that I have. Let me tell you, in the 4 minutes that I have, let me say a few more words. And the few more words are that, on one hand, the reality is actually more complicated than the story I just told. But yet it's more concrete than the story that I told. So I mean, I sort of had to compress it, and it became oversimplified and over abstract. So in reality, where was I? In reality, immediately you see trouble, and the trouble is that the quadratic form is not invertible. D is not invertible. So the whole process breaks right away. There is no such thing as the inverse. However, it's not invertible for a specific reason. And the specific reason is that there is something called gauge invariance. The integrand is invariant under a group action, and the group action is written here. So you go back to the drawing board, and you ask yourself, what happens in Rn if the Gaussian integral, or the perturbed Gaussian integral you care about, is invariant under the action of some group G. Now it's finite dimensional. So here are the G orbits, and you want to integrate, but you know that there is invariance under the G orbits. If there is invariance along the G orbits, if everything is constant along the G orbits, the quadratic form cannot possibly be non-degenerate. However, what you can do is you can choose a section. So you can choose some function F, whose zero set intersects every orbit just once. And then you can replace the original integral by that same integral times a delta function on the zeros of f. But unfortunately, you have to multiply by some ugly determinant, the so-called Fadeyev-Popov determinant. Again, I don't have time, so I'm rushing through it. But the point is, well, then you can look at perturbation theory for the determinant, rewrite perturbation theory for pictures in which you have both the Gaussian and the determinant. Alternatively, you note that determinants can be rewritten as so-called fermionic integrals or Berezini integrals. But it's really the same thing. I mean, you either call it perturbation theory for determinants or you call it anti-commuting variables. It's the same thing. The Lagrangian gets more and more complicated. The integrand gets more and more complicated as you go along. But still, it's concrete. And at the end, well, that's what you get for Chern-Simons theory. And everything is invertible. Furthermore, you can just write concretely what the Feynman rules are. So the diagrams will look like when there is a holonomy on the outside, but then there are two types of edges, one edge coming from the original A with DA, another edge coming from the determinant. These are the red edges, the so-called ghosts. And then there are concrete formulas for how to replace a diagram like this by an algebraic expression. So, you know, and these concrete formulas are essentially the inverse of D, but within this section that you've chosen. And
basically everything becomes completely concrete, and the concrete thing at the end becomes, well, again, I have minus 12 seconds to say, but the concrete things at the end becomes an integral over a certain configuration space of pullbacks of volume forms. If you've ever seen formulas for the volume forms of R3, then they're very similar to these expressions, and indeed, the end result is becomes a big integral over a big configuration space of pullbacks of volume forms, which in algebraic topology or differential geometry we know computes the degree of maps, more or less. And those degrees can also be computed by counting pre-images, which is what I did last time. So I haven't decided yet. Tomorrow, I can either, not tomorrow, I mean my next lecture, which is on Thursday, I could either go through that page more leisurely with all the details in, or move out of quantum field theory and tell you what is the significance of this invariant within topology and algebra. Okay, the invariant doesn't only have formulas, it also has a meaning. So I haven't decided which way to go. But that will be next time. And in the minus 2 minutes I have, propaganda, and then somebody should tell me which of the two notes here are the same. And that somebody will have proven himself or herself that he or she did not pay attention to the talk. So, okay, this is a three-component link and it's the only one here. This is a two-component link and it's the only one here. This is an A3 torus knot. This is a... this is a two-component link, it's the only one. This is a trefoil. This is a rather complicated 8-crossing knot, if I remember correctly. This is a 4-crossing knot. They look like they're all different. What? Yeah, so you see this is an inefficient 4-crossing knot. You could actually twist the upper part this way, and it becomes 3 crossings, and in fact it becomes this one. So the Banco de Brazil and this one, you probably can read it better than me, are in fact the same. Okay, I'm done. Is not canonical at all. And you have to show the choice of this red section. And at the end, you have to show that the result that you get is independent of the choice of the section. So, inspirationally, it's true because you always compute the same thing. But that same thing is, in fact, meaningless. It's a path integral. So, for every different red section, you'll get a different concrete formula for the path for the non-existing path integral, and you have to show that these different concrete formulas all give the same answer, regardless of which section you chose. And well, you know, but the life is hard.
So the GRB is there is a canonical procedure by DRST.
No, DRST, DRST is not a canonical procedure. DRST is the mechanism for proving that the end result is independent of the of the procedure.
We know how to do that. But yeah, need to do it. But for the here there's a choosing a metric. So the theory is not that argument doesn't fix the topological character of the theory. But I think it's not obvious.
Yes, and it works. It does.
And this can be organized by genes, which is important. This diagram can be organized by genes.
No, there is no. It's just by half the number of vertices in Euler curve.
But the Euler curve. There is non-plane and grass here. So
what?
There are non-plane and grass here.
Yes.
So you can see on what genus. Surface you can draw the process.
That's irrelevant for my purposes. You are right that, but that's not how, that's not the degree of the diagram. The degree of the diagram is just half the number of vertices, planar or not.
Yes.
Other questions?
Maybe students first.
Students first, questions?
Okay, students.
Let's ask questions. I just wondered about the operator D, so now should you solve the individual problem? It's still have positive operator, so in the determinant at some point it will come out, you can replace. How do you deal with that?
There are two answers. Well, first of all, the fact that it's non-positive is somehow irrelevant because I put an I everywhere. So I don't do the mean Gaussian integral, in which case you need positive definiteness or negative definiteness. I do the imaginary one. Now, for the imaginary Gaussian integral, there is indeed a phase factor that depends on the what is it called, the eta invariant of D. Or not quite of D, but of the things that replaces D after you do Fadeev Popov. So there is some eta invariant that comes in, but it comes in at the prefactor level. So you see, all of this in all of this, I wrote here not equal but behaves like. And what I mean meant here is that I dropped an overall multiplicative factor. The overall multiplicative factor is various powers of 2 and pi and things like that, but also this the eta invariant. Okay? So really what I'm computing in perturbation theory is well z becomes an overall multiplicative factor which depends on many, many things, which is itself complicated, times a perturbation series. So a perturbation series is sum of an h bar to the n. I've told you how to compute the a coefficients, and each of them is a topological invariant on its own. There is an independent computation of this c. C does not depend on h bar. And there is an independent computation of C, and it's a complicated and messy thing on its own, and I don't care about it for what I do. Yes, it does. Indeed. Yes, indeed. In R3, which is where I'm working, it's not interesting. But if I was working in a general free manifold, then the situation will be more complicated even yet. And I'd have to worry about C, and in fact there will be, you know, there will be many stationary components where the Chern-Simons function are, so there would be so overall the formula will not even be what I wrote here, but rather a formula with an additional summation over here over stationary points, so over flat connections, and it's even messier yet. It's not going to be.
Yeah.
Oh, maybe I didn't emphasize the jump well enough. Okay. So I should have said that, and I probably, well, and I didn't. So really, what happens is, okay, here there is a huge summation over all indices. Okay. So the formula for, in the finite dimension, the formula becomes a sum over diagrams, and for each diagram dictates to you how to form an expression that depends on many indices, and then you sum over all these indices. In the continuous case, the only thing you do is you replace summation over indices, the indices become continuous, become variables in R3, and the only thing you do is you replace summation over the indices by integration over the indices. Okay? So hence, in R3, path integrals, I'm not sure where it was before. Oh, yeah, it was before, sorry. In path integrals, you get some integrals, because some of the indices become continuous variables, points in R3, and some of the indices remain discrete, like summations from 1 to 3, the coordinates in R3, or summation from 1 to the dimension of the algebra. So instead of just summations, you get summations and integrations. But all the determinants, again, the determinants are the prefactors, and I care about the perturbative series.
But you do use them as a
step. Okay. Just a comment.
Yes.
But not only like the monks, they like to trap us to not.